Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Alexandra Ortolia-Baird, the host of the channel, and today we'll be talking to Lizzie O'Shea about her new book, Future Histories, What Ada Lovelace, Tom Paine, and the Paris Commune Can Teach Us About Digital Technology. Lizzie O'Shea, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So Lizzie, we thought we could kick off with our classic question of asking you to tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you really came to be working in this area.
Yeah, wonderful. So I am a full-time practicing lawyer. I'm a litigator and I run cases in court. And this kind of world has always introduced me to the idea of making arguments and putting forward your own position. Lawyers are very good at advocating. So we work with words as well, so it's something that I've always been intrigued by. And I felt for a long time as an advocate that I would like to experiment with long-form writing. And that sits against a backdrop of lots of activism. I'm a digital rights activist. I sit on the board of a digital rights organisation that I helped to found here in Australia. I've been active in lots of different social movements in Australia, particularly around the defence of refugee rights, for example, as well as working as a lawyer on a case that involved Aboriginal people trying to stop a nuclear waste dump being built on their land. So it's a quite diverse legal background coupled with activism that got me interested in writing more generally and using words as a way to try and change the world for the better. And I had the good fortune to be offered a scholarship to go and study at Columbia University in New York. And I went and did that as part of their human rights program. And I had the space there to really think about what contribution to this field might look like. And I always have been intrigued by digital technology. I think it's something that showcases some of humanity's best aspects and also its worst. And I wanted to really think about how I might be able to contribute to the discussion around technology from the perspective of someone who is not a technologist, and to talk about how we might be advocating collectively as a society for a more promising digital future. And that space at university really assisted me to do that. And I worked with some wonderful academics there and spurred me on to think critically, not just about social movements, but the law, but then how that interplays with technology, which the product of which really is this book.
Thank you. I think that's a very kind of clear, trajectory of how you got to Future History. So you've spoken kind of widely about what you do, but could you speak a little bit more specifically about the motivations in writing Future Histories and who you really see the book as being aimed at? I'm sure that there's probably plural audiences who it's aimed at, but perhaps you could talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is a couple of audiences in mind. So one of the things I think that was quite obvious to me as someone who's interested in digital technology is that for a time I feel like lots of people involved in left politics or left theoretical thinking, at least, or progressive movements were a bit hesitant to become involved in political questions concerning technology or policy as it comes to bear in the technological space. And part of that is, I feel, because a lot of the kind of activism in this field traditionally was associated with libertarianism and, you know, kind of the early days of the internet and the free software movement is commonly associated with that, a desire to be free from government interference and control and autonomy to be able to pursue your projects as you see fit. And in part, I felt like that created a gap. So when questions were presented in the public space around how we might contend with different forms of technology, what governments were trying to do with technology when they were trying to break encryption, for example, or how people might respond when government tries to progress powers for national security agencies and the like in very technological terms that might seem fine at first and very limited but had a very significant impact on things like digital security. Often these questions became very obscure for people who were traditionally advocating for progressive causes. So it really identified a gap there for me that there are people who are involved in political causes, campaigning from the more progressive side of politics that don't often think about technology and don't think it's their purview and feel nervous about engaging in these debates because they don't have the technological knowledge to do so. So I like to think that I can speak to that audience because I'm one of them. I'm not from a technological background, so I have to learn about these things and I'm trying to constantly digest them into an accessible format for those exact kinds of people. And then on the other side of that equation, what was I was also witnessing as I was writing this book, you know, quite obviously at the time when I was living in the States, was that many people who were saturated in technology, who grew up fiddling with computers and experimenting with software and then went on to become engineers at places like Google and Facebook, we're actually starting to see the world in a new light. And this is sort of 2016 and onwards when the effects of things like Brexit and the election of Donald Trump really highlighted the potentially very troubling role that some of these big tech companies have in disrupting our democracy for the worse. And this cohort of people were starting to become radicalized and interested in politics. They weren't your usual suspects because they you know, tech workers weren't traditionally organized into unions. They had no need for it in some ways, people would argue, because they were paid well. But in fact, that's not what was going on. That tech workers were starting to question their role in the systems of power that they were helping to build, but also how they related as workers compared to their colleagues who had varying degrees of rights within their organizations, how they might be able to start organizing together to make changes both to their workplace but also society. And it occurred to me that we can really speak to those people about how that kind of work's been done in the past and how it can be repurposed and we can learn from that for our present moment to become more effective. And so I really wanted to give some context to social movements that might be familiar to those who've been involved in activist politics for a while, less familiar if you're coming to it for the first time, and try and speak to them and talk about how technology really has a role to play in making the world better, but it relies on us organizing and working together as activists. So there's those two audiences, and what I wanted to do is kind of build a bridge between them so that we'd have common concepts and understandings of the kinds of questions we would face, the kinds of problems we might encounter, and how history can be a very useful guide for navigating them. And that, in fact, a lot of the problems that might seem quite novel of our present moment have, in fact, got a much longer history. And in doing so, I would hope that we could find common cause and build a strong movement to build a more democratic future.
Thanks, Lizzie. That's fantastic. And I think you've really outlined to listeners what exactly the book really conveys so strongly. So I think that leads quite nicely into my next question. Do you think you could walk us through the general structure of the book to give listeners an overview of sorts of kind of how your argument progresses and what's really included?
Sure. So the key premise of the book is that I believe that we can make the present the cause of a different future, but we've got our best chance of achieving that if we use history as a guide. So in essence, it's looking at thinkers and social movements from the past and how those movements and thinkers had ideas and were engaged in activism and activity that has a lot of relevance to debates today that might seem quite distant and removed from them. So that's the kind of device that I employ throughout the book, and I do it in relation to various questions that are posed particularly by the development of digital technology. And I mean, I should say, I do think there's obviously limitations in that kind of approach to understanding history. I don't think we're always doomed to repeat history for either good or ill. I think it's there's many interesting criticisms of that kind of idea of using history to be as a guide for the future. But I think provided you've got those caveats, I think it can be a very instructive exercise to look back at movements and thinkers from the past and understand how they situated themselves within their society and how they could be influential. And it's one of my go-to strategies as an activist, I suppose, when I'm feeling a bit despondent or I wonder whether I'm being effective. I often think back and look and read about others who've confronted similar hurdles or difficulties or political crises in their own societies, and it's always really exciting and I think nourishing for the soul to read about others who've confronted these problems and done their best to overcome them or tried very hard, even if they're unsuccessful, had an impact, I think, that could be felt beyond their years. So it's a strategy that I've employed to keep myself engaged in politics even when it's been difficult to do so. And so I was hoping to kind of share that sentiment in my writing. So the way that I do that is, for example, I look at the issue of surveillance, both corporate surveillance and state surveillance. So for the purposes of something like corporate surveillance, I looked at how Freudian thinking actually has relevance to how we might understand the political economy of surveillance capitalism and how coming to know ourselves in a Freudian way can be a very liberating way of reclaiming your identity from companies that are trying to remake you as a set of data points for grooming as a consumer. And so I try to link up those two kinds of ideas, Freudian thinking and surveillance capitalism, and find a way to talk about perhaps breaking that model that is so dominant of our experience of the web. In relation to state surveillance, I try to draw a line between the enormous surveillance state that currently exists in the digital age and the origins of policing, the first modern police force, which was created in London at the early stages of capitalism at the end of the 19th century, at the end of the 18th century, I should say, where there was a need for a professionalized force to surveil people to keep and manage and maintain the status quo with its social divisions, and how surveillance is a very effective way of internalizing a sense that you can't resist, that you need to comply, and that's what a lot of digital surveillance does today as well, and the capacity of the internet is being used for that kind of purpose, which is a great tragedy in human terms. So that's kind of two examples of the way in which I employ this device. And then I look at other topics, so things like the automation of work, and I look at the 8-hour day movement as a way to kind of reclaim perhaps or argue for a redistribution of the benefits of automation. I look at technological utopianism and the history of that idea and how so much of it is present in our current moment with when we look to people like Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos as the visionaries of the future, and how that very naive technological utopianism conceals, I think, quite conservative politics. And I look at movements in the past that also were technologically utopian and their particular limitations and how they're similar in these ways. I look at other things like the history of the free software movement and look at how, you know, lots of software that we use every day has actually quite a radical history in terms of it was built by people who didn't really comply with the rules of the market, that were kind of upending that before eventually software became a commodity that was, a multi-billion dollar industry and has made a tiny section of the population very wealthy, whereas in fact software was perhaps best designed and continues to be best designed when it's done in a collaborative way rather than a proprietary one, in line with the origins of the free software movement. And so we might wish to revive it. So that's kind of the approach. And there's a few different other kind of technological questions, I suppose, that I consider using historical reference points as a way to understand our present conundrums, but then also try and map out an alternative future.
So you've already touched a little bit upon that, but I'd like to kind of delve a little deeper. So you begin the book by talking about our need for a usable past for a democratic future, which in and of itself is a fantastic phrase. I found this very convincing. So could you break down what you mean by this usable past and perhaps the history of that term? And perhaps then also touch a little bit of, on the connection between history and governance, because I think that's really a topic that's at the core of the book, is this connection between history and governance.
Mm. Yeah, so the term usable past comes from, actually, it has literary origins. There was a famous essay by an American literary critic talking called Van Brooks, talking about the need to build up a usable past for the purposes of creating a particularly American vision of literature. And the essay is, I think, beautifully written, and he's talking about the idea of a usable past in quite a specific context, but it's an idea that I think is worth revisiting in this context as well, which is obviously why I framed the book around it. And so his kind of argument essentially is that we need to cast back and look and shine a light on particular moments in history that are relevant for the present to craft a narrative and a kind of a mode of thinking and understanding each other that might be able to reclaim our capacity to change the future. And he's talking about crafting a particularly American voice in the context of literature. And I think, I guess for the left, I think we can recraft an idea of what technology is, how it's been developed, its potential, its failings in its current moment, but also what we could turn its immense potential to in terms of fixing some of the most serious problems that we confront. And that's one of my concerns, actually, that a lot of people understand who are engaged in progressive movements understand technology as being this overwhelmingly negative force that is framed around surveillance and the monetization of the web, and that largely terrible things happen on the internet. And we might use it to organize and see kind of movements explode online, but really it's a force for evil. And I sort of wanted to say, well, let's craft a narrative where we can talk about its potential as well, that it can be an immense force for good. And I don't mean that in a naive way. I mean as a repository of human knowledge, of human connection. We have a huge amount of potential there that we didn't have in the past, and it's our obligation, I think, to figure out, sorry about that, I don't know what happened in the background there. We have an obligation to figure out how we can transform its potential into something real. And you know, that's identifying the forces at play that I think stop and limit the potential of the internet. And the two that come to mind most obviously are the market, the role of profit-making enterprises in taking ownership of the web and transforming it into something that suits their purposes, and then also the state as a force that enters and tries to use the potential of the web to manage and maintain social division and the status quo. And so organizing to resist that, I wanted to create a past, a usable past, a sense of history that might be able to identify what's stopping us, what's holding us back from making use of the potential of technology, and open up our thinking a bit. Not in an effort to be naive utopians, but as a way of understanding how immensely powerful this technology will be to solve problems that we're confronting, like public participation, like climate change, like wealth inequality, the organizing that we'll need to do to change how society is structured to address some of those problems will require technological solutions, and how they are produced will rely on our political organizing and who holds power in society. And so that's what I was getting at in terms of understanding the usable past as a way of unlocking an alternative future.
And I think, you know, there you're really fitting into this quite new trend of historians who are talking about reconceptualizing the role of history and also of historians in society and politics. And I'm thinking of, you know, people like David Armitage and the History Manifesto. You know, historians like to talk about the uses and abuses of history, really focusing on the abuses. But there does seem to be a shift towards thinking about history as something that is, as you say, usable in a non-naive and political way. So I was really, I was really touched by that, and kind of really saw how the book is kind of fitting into this shift, which I think is really important, not just for the historical disciplines, but also in terms of society and politics.
Well, I mean, I must say, of course, I have a degree in history, but I'm not a practicing historian by any stretch, and I don't think it's foolish, though, to suggest that when you write history, you are engaging in a political act. And, of course, I think many people could accuse my approach to history as being simplistic or potentially limiting or ignoring some of the complexities of things from the past as they relate to the present. But I think also the whole discipline is obviously a practice in understanding the past from the perspective of the present, which is invariably not something that's neutral or objective. And to that end, I think I'm prepared to accept that criticism or invite dialogue in that respect, with an understanding that we're all doing something along the same lines. And so, you know, you may as well be honest about it. One of the motivating stories, I suppose, that got me really keen to kind of finish this project and get it out into the world is I was reading an article about a guy called Ben Horowitz, who some of your listeners may know, is a well-known venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. And he gives this presentation where he identifies one of his heroes from the past. And he talks about his hero being Toussaint Louverture, who was the revolutionary leader in Haiti in their struggle for independence. And what Ben Horowitz does, because it's kind of discombobulating to think of a venture capitalist having, you know, a Haitian revolutionary as his hero, was he says, oh, you know, Toussaint Louverture changed the culture of his country, and CEOs, you can change the culture of your company and your country as well. He draws a line between revolutionaries in the past and entrepreneurs of the present. And my point is that if we aren't going to talk about history, other people will, and they will do it with a particular political motive in mind. And someone like Ben Horowitz does it because he wants to valorize tech entrepreneurs as being the people who bring progress to society. And that, I think, is very worthy of criticism. And it requires, you know, obviously academic interrogation, but also mainstream understandings of history, of historical debates, of an understanding that history can be interpreted in multiple ways, but arguing for a particular cause or a particular interpretation with, you know, with reasoning behind it is a job that I think we need to get people doing, not just allow the venture capitalists to do it for us, and not just that it's just the preserve of academia either, that debates that are existing on the ground that struggle for rights in the workplace or in public life do, I think, need a sense of history so they can both debunk it and reclaim it for their own purposes. And that was one of the key sources of motivation. Perhaps it was just my burning anger, I'm not sure, but that story really got me motivated to continue with this project and get it out into the world.
So you do that, and you do that very well throughout the chapter. So I'd like to just skip ahead a little bit to chapter 4, which is wonderfully entitled "Technology is as biased as its makers, exploding cars, racist algorithms, and design beholden to the bottom line." So this is, for many people who work in, you know, digital humanities and digital sociology, a very kind of known concept. But could you explain this issue of technological bias and kind of, you know, algorithmic bias to listeners, perhaps with reference to the incredibly shocking case of Professor LaTanya Sweeney, which you outline in this?
Yes. So LaTanya Sweeney is an African-American professor at Harvard University, and she's very well qualified. And I heard her speak about this when I was in the United States. She was looking for a paper of hers online, and so she Googled her name, and the advertisement that came up under her name when she was looking for the paper said, "LaTanya Sweeney arrested," with a question mark. And she was kind of curious about this because she'd not been arrested, and she didn't have a criminal record, and she clicked through the ad, and it was a service which collates public records about people, and it demonstrated that she didn't in fact have a criminal record, but of course the text of the ad would suggest potentially otherwise. And one of her colleagues, who had a much more white name, I can't quite recall, I think it was Adam, I was going to say Adam Smith there, but I don't think it was that. It was Adam Barnes or something. He Googled his name, and he got an ad that was similar, but it didn't have the inflammatory headline. It had a different set of text, which didn't suggest that he'd been arrested, but it said, you know, record checks for this man. And the argument, well, what it spurred for her was a curiosity as to why the ads that were being produced or thrown up in response to queries were articulated in different ways. And she investigates this and reverse engineers essentially the Google AdWords process and works out that African American names are more likely to produce a certain text associated with that particular advertiser that were inflammatory and suggested that that African American people had criminal records, which is an awful insight into how there's essentially some organization that goes on that people are encountering the web individually and don't perhaps realize that these trends are going on in the background that are in fact quite biased and racist towards people. And it's kind of unthinking because Google's, you know, maintains that it doesn't choose the kinds of words that are put in ads. It doesn't have a responsibility to do anything about it. And for my money, I think that's an inadequate answer and that they have a responsibility to look into these things and to catch this kind of racism before it becomes imbued into the system or written into our digital lives. And the argument essentially is that there's all sorts of ways in which we can code decision-making for machines to do based on certain kind of data. Too often we're seeing examples where the outcomes might be biased in a particular way, often along the lines of race, often along the lines of gender, and in all sorts of other ways as well. There's lots of other famous examples. Amazon ran their resumes for a particular job in response to a job ad through an algorithm that produced only men as being appropriate candidates for the role. And that's probably based on past conduct in Amazon in terms of hiring. As you can imagine, that's a logical decision for the computer to make. But someone's made the decision to code the system like that. And we need to ask why that's happened. And we need to think about these problems and try and catch them before they are deployed on unsuspecting people. And there's all sorts of people who are doing interesting work on those kinds of ideas. But I like this chapter because what I'm trying to do in this chapter is talk about why law and regulation is important. And as a lawyer, you can see why that holds a special place in my heart, that argument. And what I do is I talk about the design process and how you can regulate the design process to make it more safe. And this is something that we've done before. And the example I use is the Ford Pinto crisis, which is a scandal that you learn about in law school, whereby Ford allowed a car to go into production, even though they knew it had very serious safety flaws because they were motivated to do so in order to capture a certain market share against its competitors. And it's kind of an appalling example of how design was required to comply with the needs of the bottom line. And the people who paid the price were customers who, in the case of the Ford Pinto, burnt to death in their vehicles. And it's unclear how many, but thousands possibly were died in this way, and it was a design fault that was easily fixable, quite cheaply fixable, but Ford didn't have the interest in doing so. And then I start to talk about why regulation of the car industry has in fact been very effective at making it safer, and that regulation of how we design algorithms in all their different contexts, I think, would make the internet and our engagement with it much safer as well.
And I think this chapter is really fantastic for demonstrating the connections between history and technology, because, you know, a lot of the biases and a lot of the kind of racism and subjectivities that we build into code and into algorithms are in many ways historical remnants. Mm. So we're actually building and encoding the past into our kind of digital futures. And I found that really, really kind of an important case to be made, and you made it incredibly strongly. But I want to then move a little bit on to chapter 5, which is Technological Utopianism is Dangerous, where you talk about the Paris Commune of 1871 and what we might learn from their reorganization of society. Could you explain a little bit how you envisage this connection between the Paris Commune and kind of current governance and society, and why you make this particular kind of warning against technological utopianism?
Mm. Yeah, well, so the setup, I suppose, is that I feel that a lot of talk that comes out of people who are in positions of power in the public sphere, people who are influential commentators on these topics, can be quite undiscerning and utopian in terms of how we understand the potential of technology. And, you know, a good example is Jeff Bezos recently talking about how he wanted there to be a population of 1 trillion and we'd all live outside of the Earth's atmosphere in space, and people would, you know, come and visit Earth down you know, for holidays. And people were like, what an amazing vision for society. And meanwhile, these are the, you know, this is the same guy who could do much more to address something like climate change, who, leaves his workforce to toil in misery. And so what could we expect from a world in which Jeff Bezos is very powerful, where there's a trillion people? Probably more of the same. And I find it very frustrating that a lot of the discourse around both visions for the future generally, but also in relation to technology specifically, that kind of discussion, we often look to people like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg for the sources of inspiration. And I think they're actually quite narrow in their thinking, because they've made their money in a particular way and all they can think of is more of the same, which for everybody else is not a very rosy future. So that's the context in which I wanted to kind of question the idea that we should be utopian about technology and how we could also be optimistic about it. And it got me looking back at previous movements for that related to technological utopianism. And one of them, most obviously, is perhaps some of your readers know, a man called Edward Bellamy wrote a book, which was a technological utopian book in the late 19th century. And it talks about what a world might look like after someone fell asleep in a kind of state of mesmerism. It's all very 19th century Victorian, but it's an American book, I should say. But he wakes up in a new world in which there's a new world order, and it's what's happened is technology has been accelerated. So all the problems of the 19th century have been solved, like labor unrest, like the filth and misery of the Industrial Revolution. And it was an extremely popular book. There were Bellamy clubs across the United States, and many other writers kind of followed suit. And it really captured the imagination of people in the late 19th century. And I kind of, in the course of reading about this, I found it kind of troubling, because it was a very similar kind of approach. We just invest in technology, the problems associated with it, social, political ones, will be solved. And that struck me as a very naive proposition. And the more I read about it, the more I realized that, in fact, this kind of movement of technological utopianism was a reaction of sorts to that other big event of the late 19th century. The Paris Commune in 1871 that you mentioned. And there's a dialogue going on between William Morris, who I am very fond of as a figure in history. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, mostly for his beautiful decorative designs, but also for being a socialist. He's in conversation with Edward Bellamy about his book and describing how narrow-minded it was and how uninventive and unimaginative it was, because he was essentially committed to the same form of society, just with the acceleration of technology, and the assumptions that would fix problems was a mistake. And, of course, William Morris was a great defender of the Paris Commune. And what I think is going on there is really that the Paris Commune was this incredible experiment in applied democracy, that people upended all sorts of previously accepted wisdom, ideas about how what is the right things to in terms of culture and taste, the right way to do business, the right way to work, and started to reorganize society in very concrete ways, using essentially applied forms of democracy to do so. And of course, it was crushed, as I'm sure your listeners know. But the legacy of it is still quite contentious, and I think it could have gone two ways: an embrace of the idea that applied democracy is a good thing for society, or an idea that that kind of experiment was wrong, and that in fact what we need is technocrats in charge to accelerate the development of technology, and that will solve our problems. And so that's how I kind of get to this idea that perhaps what we need is kind of more of a commitment to understanding applied forms of democracy rather than outsourcing the problem solving of society to technocrats, engineers, and coders. And it's an argument really that we need more engagement, more public participation in some of these questions rather than less.
And I think you make that very clear then in one of the following chapters, which is on collaborative work is liberating and effective, where you stay within the 19th century. And I think we could possibly come back to that later, how the 19th century is a very, very kind of important turning point and kind of historical point for a lot of the chapters that you write. But so in this chapter, you talk about the Luddites, and you argue this kind of point that a lot of our current dilemmas with technology are kind of repeating themes that have just been continually cropping up throughout history. So do you think you could outline for readers, for listeners, I don't know how familiar they are with kind of what the Luddites were doing and what they were calling for, But could you kind of introduce them and perhaps some of the parallels that you see between them and some of these current day themes like hacker culture, open source code?
Yeah, I love the Luddites. I always think they're another set of great characters from history that are fun to learn about. They're a favorite among Silicon Valley types to talk about because they're always lamenting the idea of being a Luddite, which I think is always very amusing because I'm not sure they fully understood the historical significance of the Luddites as a movement. It's traditionally associated with being kind of anti-technology, that you break machines, that you don't want to be engaging with the development of technology and adopting new forms of working or engagement with technology because you're anti-technology. And in fact, of course, the actual Luddites developed a reputation for that because they were into frame breaking. They were smashing technology throughout England in the 19th century. And really, the only way I think to understand them is not as people who are against progress or technology, but almost as a labor movement. They were contesting the idea that machines would take away labor, artisan labor, that would degrade humans into being cogs in a machine rather than people with autonomy and craftsmanship and engagement with their labor and you know, being able to appreciate and see the work that they do in the world around them. And but they were very contentious. And one of the people that defended them in a speech to the House of Lords, I believe it was the House of Lords, was Lord Byron, who articulated a defense of them, complaining that using law to try and crush them as a movement was a mistake because what they were protesting had some moral weight to it, that in the Industrial Revolution was causing misery and degrading people who were doing this kind of work. And so that movement to break frames actually came from a place of moral good that ought to be paid attention to. And I mentioned Lord Byron because the chapter is kind of framed around his daughter, who's Ada Lovelace, who, as some of your listeners may know, was is widely believed or attributed with being the first ever computer programmer. And so I talk about her because she made the leap between calculation and computation. And what's interesting about her, of course, is that she's a woman, which is not what you'd usually hear in relation to talking about technology, that it's a bro culture and full of men. But in fact, a woman was the one who kicked it all off, which is a nice little circularity in that part of history. But the point of the chapter is to say that actually the origins of the software development and lots of software that we use today, that actually came in conditions of freedom, working in essentially a kind of form of working that wasn't touched by the market. And this is kind of the early days of the free software movement in universities, mainly in America, but also other places, where people were experimenting with these new things called computers, with writing programs for them, much in the same way that someone like Ada Lovelace did. And they were working in kind of very collaborative ways. There was no sense that you owned what you wrote as code. There was no sense that you would monetize that and turn it into something else. And that all changed quite quickly throughout the late 70s and 80s. And, of course, it became a multi-trillion-dollar industry, which is what it is now. But it's interesting, I think, that there is still this kind of culture among tech geeks where they like fiddling with their computer, they like knowing what it does, they like looking under the hood, they don't like to be told what to do by a company who makes proprietary software. And I kind of appreciate that approach to understanding and using technology. And they like to work together as well to kind of fix problems. They find problems, they solve them, and then they share it with others. And that's a really effective way of writing computer programs, of creating source code, because it helps to see more problems, it helps to make technology that serves its users rather than, say, serves a company who profits from developing it and updating it. And I think we ought to revive that and look to more kind of open source products, but also making sure that those kinds of work environments are somewhere that we can cultivate, that we can make them better, because, of course, they had terrible limitations, these kinds of workplaces. Often these universities in the United States were again full of men. But I think the idea that you might work collaboratively without necessarily being beholden to the needs of the market, that you might share your work and that you might together identify problems, solve them for yourself, but share those solutions with others, that's a good approach to developing software, and we ought to revive it as much as we can. And we ought to bring as many people we can into that way of working because it's very effective. And that's what I'm trying to explain in that chapter. Tell that story of the free and open software open source software movement and kind of make the point that the tech industry wasn't always one that was dominated by billion-dollar companies, that it was a bit rat-baggy and a bit alternative and a bit anti-market, and that's some good origins that we ought to revive.
So a particularly salient chapter in the book, considering the current global kind of political climate, and one that really struck me actually, is called Digital Citizenship is a Collective Endeavor, Tom Paine's Revolutionary Idea of Public Participation. And here you use Thomas Paine's political philosophy to explore concepts of rights, enfranchisement, political and social participation, but in the digital age. And I was really, really taken by this chapter. And I wonder if you could expand upon your point a little bit, that access to the network is fundamental for engagement, participation, and democratic decision making.
Mm. Yeah, well, Tom Paine, I think, is the only kind of founding father there of the United States that I really like. And he's often forgotten, I think, in discussions about the origins of the United States, and or he's often claimed as a figure by the right, because he was very critical of government for obvious reasons. But he's someone, I think, that was contending with the problem of a political system that might work in theory, but with economic inequality, it would really cease to function. I mean, he kind of phrased it in different ways, but I think that's where the idea leads, that you can have a very good formal system, but to keep it accountable, you need people who are able to do that work. And for that reason, he was always a critic of government. But he made the point that, you know, voting really is not enough. And I think we need to kind of build spaces that are democratic, not just assume that the formalistic nature of our democracy will mean that it works. And that's the idea that I'm exploring there. So the network, I think basically we all need universal access to the internet, and I think that should be a policy of governments that are sensible in the 21st century, trying to cultivate that so that people can engage not just in public participation but in work and cultural life as well. And that's never been more obvious than in our particular moment where so many people are required to work from home. But then I think we also need to consider how the network can build in its own inequalities, and there's all sorts of ways in which that can happen. I talk a little bit about net neutrality, which is a perennial issue on the left, which is or in digital spaces, I should say, which is about how we structure the rules around how traffic moves through the network, and should we prioritize some form of traffic over others. And it's a debate that's been raging in the United States for a long time, but there's a strong lobby there, which has only been emboldened under President Trump, to actually allow certain private industries and private companies to allow their traffic to be prioritized over others. And that this would, in fact, I think, destabilize and really undermine some of the key benefits of the internet and the open nature of it. And it would be very destructive to our sense of public life and, you know, our dependence on technology, that we shouldn't be allowing others to, because they have wealth and power, to be able to destroy one of the most important developments, I think, of the last 100 years. And so it's a claim about why net neutrality is not some obscure technological debate. It's actually something that's quite critical to the functioning of our democracy. And we need to start finding ways to allow people to participate in the network, but also that the network is built in a way that it facilitates that participation as equals, rather than allowing certain forces in society to gain influence and control and shape the network around their interests.
And another chapter that I think then follows on from this, that it has so much resonance for 2020, is the one that you call the digital world is an environment that needs to be cared for. Mm. Ancient forms of governance hold relevance for modern infrastructure. So I have to admit, on reading just the title of this chapter, I had assumed in my incredibly Western mindset that you were going to be pivoting around the classical and ancient Western political canon. Mm-hmm. In which to talk about democratic governance. So that already for me was just such a terrible reminder of the bias as someone who is an intellectual historian brings to the table already, which we can probably circle back to. But so in this chapter, you actually locate your argument in ancient and in many ways still very contemporary indigenous philosophies, histories, and ideas of governance. And from that, you propose an entirely different intellectual history of digital infrastructure and technology. Now, I hope it's probably very clear to listeners why Indigenous peoples and cultures need to play a more significant role in societies and politics across the globe. But can you perhaps explain the types of futures? So coming back to this concept of the future, the types of futures you see as being shaped by Indigenous concepts of governance that you explore in the chapter?
I thought it was just critically important to talk about this issue, in part because of what you described, which I think is common when we think about the history of philosophy or history around ideas of governance. We usually have a Western frame in mind, and I'm obviously Australian, so I've lived on Aboriginal land that was never ceded for most of my life. This is the oldest continuously surviving civilization in the world. They've survived on a continent that is quite hostile in ecological terms and managed to thrive. And it's only in the last 200 years that that society's really been decimated in quite unforgivable terms. I think that we are going through a bit of a moment in Australia, at least, where we're starting to talk a little bit more about what we might have lost, but also how we might be able to learn from those cultures, particularly given the ecological moment that we're facing. Aboriginal people survived here for tens of thousands of years, possibly between 60 and 80,000 years, and it's only in the last 200 years that the environment has become so significantly hostile to the human population, and I think that is telling. So what I'm getting at is, are there things that we can learn from Aboriginal culture in Australia? I also look a little bit at Maori culture in New Zealand and some Canadian Indigenous thinkers there who talk about how political thinking can be influenced by Indigenous modes of governance and ideas around these questions. And I'm trying to look at how we might be able to learn from those societies while acknowledging, of course, that they're diverse within them and there's huge differences among them, that we might wish to start looking to those people at least for some guidance about how we might be able to get through our present moment. And what I think is the overwhelming kind of lesson that you learn from Aboriginal people in Australia is that they have a very different relationship with land, not as something to be exploited, but as something that they belong to, that they have obligations to, that they collectively own. They're not, it's not an individual conception of ownership. And as a resource that is life-giving to them and a source of knowledge and sustainable life, you can see why that's been a very effective way of surviving in this hostile continent. And I suppose my argument really is that the internet is an incredible resource that belongs to all of us. It's life-giving. It's now the backbone of things like food production systems. It's obviously the repository of human knowledge in many ways. It's got, ways in which we connect and participate in public life. And for that reason, it's got to be something that we have to care for better, and we have to treat as a resource that belongs to all of us rather than something that people can exploit and own and control at the expense of other people. And I think that's, there's points at which all these metaphors kind of break down, but I think it's a very telling, it's very telling, I suppose, that this kind of Western mode of domination, exploitation, and use of resources until their depletion is a philosophy that's been taken by a small few into online life. And you were talking before about how we're encoding kind of things that we've done in the past into our digital future. And I think this is true of this approach to how we engage in online life as well, that the internet is there for advertising and exploiting people and getting people to do things they don't want to do. The hardware of the internet, the wires and the cables that carry this traffic, they're to be owned and exploited, and then people are to pay certain companies to be able to access it, rather than another approach, which could be, okay, well, this is communal infrastructure, let's figure out how to make it work effectively for everybody, not just a small section of society, and let's protect it so that future generations will be able to benefit from that kind of encoding rather than the one that we currently have.
And in that chapter, you give a fantastic example from New Zealand of how a river comes to be a kind of legal entity, a legal person. And I think that, this is not only just a very interesting kind of case that you present, but with regards to actually reconceptualizing what it means to be part of society, what the law means, I think, you give some excellent examples about how we actually need to be to be stripping right back and re-kind of thinking about what it means to be kind of part of a system and part of a society. Mm. I don't know if you kind of wanted to maybe expand a little bit about the example from New Zealand, just for listeners who perhaps are not aware of this. But I mean, it really is very striking, especially for those who, you know, are perhaps interested in political theory or intellectual history, because it really is, from a Western perspective, so incredibly alien, I suppose, in terms of how we consider legal fictions and kind of legal identities.
Yeah, absolutely. And as a lawyer, I suppose I always think about legal personhood and what is signified by that, and how we're very happy for a company, even though that's a creation, a fiction, to be considered a legal person, but something real like a natural resource or a natural feature or land is not able to have its own personality, which I think is telling. The way the law has evolved is certainly around the mode of property, of course, and the way of interpreting the natural world through that lens as property to be exploited rather than having its own identity and worthy of respect. And the story that you mentioned is about how a certain river in New Zealand was granted a legal personality, which was a very novel kind of idea, but actually has a few different precedents around the world. But you know, what I talk about a little bit in that story is how the negotiations took place between the New Zealand government, who I think was certainly engaged in good faith negotiations with the local Maori tribe who spoke for that country, and how discombobulating it was for both of them to have this kind of category error in terms of understanding the land, because of course the New Zealand government understood ownership in a particular way associated with rights, as property is a bundle of rights about which you can work with or you can exploit, whereas the Maori people were kind of completely at odds with this. They don't understand land in that way. I mean, they're not stupid. They understand how 21st century conceptions of land work, but it's in spiritual terms, in moral terms, in political terms, they understood land to be something that is owned collectively, that you have responsibility for, that you look after, and that you're not an owner to dominate the country, but in fact you're a custodian for future generations. And kind of even getting the basic language in place was a difficulty that this negotiation faced. And I think that's a really interesting thing to remember, because we take so much for granted in terms of how we arrange society around legal rights and around legal personhood. And it comes at a cost, which is that these collective resources end up being depleted and exploited and dominated by those who hold power. And maybe we wish to start revising that and thinking much more expansively, learning from others as to how we might be able to structure ownership and collective ownership of common resources in ways that protect them for future generations rather than allow them to be exploited and dominated by a small select few.
And something that really comes up in this chapter, and actually which recurs throughout the book, which I wanted to touch on, is you put a lot of importance into thinking about the digital world as a place or an environment which has material nature, rather than as a service or some kind of other more abstract concept. So basically, it's a thing that we have collectively built and are continuing to build, rather than like a phenomenon which is acting upon society. So what do you think are the potential repercussions of this shift in perception? You know, if we were to, you know, as a society, as a public globally, to kind of rethink the digital world in this way, you know, what would be the outcome?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think anyone's put it to me like that, but I think that's very telling. I appreciate that perspective. It's an interesting way to think about it, because, of course, you can think about the internet as, you know, switches, as cables, as hardware, as software, and then you can think about it as a constructed political place that you engage with to do work, to find love, to talk to your family, to kind of enjoy culture and consume things like that. And I think the idea of understanding it as this construct allows us then to question why it is this way. Too often society is treated as an object that technology does things to, that we're not a group of people with agency and desire, that in fact technology is like this force of nature. It's like the weather. It just develops in a particular linear way. It's always just astonishing and surprising, but it's not as though it's something that we can influence. And that's a perspective that has been created for a particular purpose. I don't mean that in a conspiracy theory way, but what I mean is it's constructed. It's something that we can question and ask to be changed. And that's the idea, I suppose, about thinking about it as a place that we can put effort into understanding its building blocks from all layers of the internet, from its base layer, its cables, all the way up to how you might engage with the interface, and think about ways in which we might be able to do that in inclusive and collective ways that are non-discriminatory, that don't carry over oppression from the world that we inhabit as people, carry that into our digital spaces, that we have a chance to disorganize those kinds of forms of oppression and discrimination and reorganize society around much more radical ideas of equality and fellowship and collectivity. And so I think thinking about it as a place in that way is helpful for understanding it as something that we might be able to have an influence on rather than something that we have to just simply accept.
And that leads very nicely actually into my next question, which is reading through the book, you know, something that kept recurring to me is concerns digital and technological literacy and, you know, basic knowledge of digital sociology. So, you know, I teach digital humanities, so I'm perpetually aware of how, in spite of, you know, growing public knowledge about the perniciousness of Amazon and Facebook and, you know, these other, you know, internet megaliths, you know, people are still being exploited by digital platforms or just generally unaware of what's going on in the background. Of the softwares that they use, of the databases that they're using. And, you know, this goes for, you know, esteemed academics, you know, they're all using Google Books, but without any perhaps knowledge of, you know, the representativeness of, you know, what's actually out there or how, OCR softwares are, you know, terrible, you know, things like this. And your book makes a really, really clear case for why tech companies and governments should be more transparent and, of course, better regulated. And you know, this is the most important structural change that, of course, needs to be made. But is there something else that can be done perhaps at lower levels? You know, should these issues be given greater stock in school curriculums or at universities? Should there be, you know, greater public awareness campaigns? You know, if I think of, you know, digital public awareness campaigns, they're always to do with, oh, you're going to get hacked by this person who's going to take your credit card details. But, you know, should there be more awareness, you know, saying actually when you're using these technologies, you need to be aware of these biases that are being built into them. You need to be aware of X, Y, and Z in order to create this much more kind of, I guess, literate kind of public when it comes to, you know, digital sociology.
Yeah, because I don't think we really have a choice. If we're going to have a functioning public sphere, we're going to have people who, in spite of the algorithms that Facebook uses to keep people on device, to keep people entertained and draw them in and give them what they more of what they want in a sense, or cultivate what they want, to create a kind of relationship of addiction with the platform, which invariably leads to more extremism and more division between people. No two people see the same internet. No two people see the same social media platform, which is breaking down public space. So if we are going to maintain a kind of idea of public space, of dialogue, of a collective sense of, you know, humanity as it may take form in a particular society, we absolutely need to have citizens who and people who have a knowledge of how these systems work. And, you know, I do think we need to kind of turf legal concepts that might be underpinning some of the benighted ways in which we engage with these platforms, like the idea that you consent to the terms and conditions of a particular platform or a service in all their, you know, tens of thousands of words is a fiction. So why do we continue to allow that to happen? And why would we, why wouldn't we start to think about how privacy, I suppose, is, I say privacy, I suppose, because I think privacy is often a substitute word for lots of other words like freedom and autonomy, how we can kind of re-encode in the legal system a form of protection or the capacity for individuals to protect their privacy meaningfully without necessarily understanding it through contractual means. So, of course, there's things that we need to do at a legal level, but absolutely I think part of the way in which we're going to achieve that kind of reform, because it doesn't come out of nowhere, is to empower people to ask these kinds of questions, to appreciate how these systems work and start to ask why we can't have it better. And I'm sure that starts at a young age. I think it starts with parents when they have the time to be able to talk to their children. I'm not sure it's always easy, but that kind of digital literacy, that you're going into a world that will try and influence you and manipulate you in a variety of ways. Here's how you can be an active person that's a critical thinker and meets these kinds of presentations with a mind that is questioning, and that builds a basis for greater knowledge and capacity to challenge these kinds of structures and norms. I mean, I think it's education in schools as well is going to play an enormous role. I mean, I would say I think the technological community, I'm very excited by the kinds of radical organising we've seen in places like Silicon Valley, but I think as a general proposition, I'm really looking forward to that movement breaking out and becoming something that's more normalized and more widespread, because I think we do need more collaboration with technologists across the board in all of kind of civil society, but also more generally people who are critical thinkers rather than just the leaders of the industry, who are helping to make policy, to ask those critical questions, to develop educational programs that can be effective for holding these kinds of big companies to heal or to holding them to account. So I'm looking forward to a world in which there's more radicals who've come out of the technology space and more people with critical thinking skills that can contribute to normalizing the idea that we should question how we engage with the digital world and we should become active citizens in trying to change it. And I think that will be a big part of it. And then, of course, an openness from those who are already engaged in that kind of activism and work to understanding these issues as technological as well. I mean, you're right to point out that education will be a key source of it. So I do think if you're an academic or an activist working in relation to public education, that's a technological issue. And that's true for lots of different kind of movements and civil society organisations. The point being that digital rights aren't just something for digital rights activists to advocate on. It's actually something that all organisations need to start embracing, becoming aware of, and start advocating for in their own particular field, because that's how we'll build up the capacity to create movements that can hold lawmakers accountable, that can create better policy, and that can take on some of the most powerful technology companies that, but for these kinds of movements, will continue to shape the web according to their own interests.
So that actually segues so nicely into my final question for you, which is actually, you know, the book cuts across so many different fields. You know, it's science and technology studies, digital sociology, politics, history. But, you know, this is the intellectual history channel. So I wondered if you could briefly reflect on the significance of your work for intellectual history, you know, that being the history of ideas, their genesis, evolution, and most importantly, their articulation and context. And perhaps the role that, you know, intellectual historians or history can play in ushering in this democratic future that you propose. Because circling back to something that you said at the beginning, you know, I was really struck by something you said in your introduction regarding current day revisionism, which presents, you know, this outlook that so many intellectual historians have really worked quite tirelessly to try and undermine. And I'm going to quote from you here where you say, "It's these revolutionary moments recast as cultural shifts generated by disruptive thought leaders. History understood as the march of great entrepreneurial CEOs. This kind of thinking sees the future as defined by universal progress rather than by a messy, contradictory struggle between different interests and forces, and never driven by the aspirations of those from below. It reduces the value of human agency to entrepreneurialism and empty consumerism." And I mean, firstly, I mean, the prose is just fantastic and incredibly captivating, but it really kind of hit me as a wave, as someone who, you know, is part of a discipline which has really tried to do this, to you know, think about history from below, to think about, you know, history as not just this kind of universal progress. But yet we see these, you know, as you say, entrepreneurial CEOs, these revolutionary leaders who are kind of perpetuating this type of history that, you know, people have worked to try and undermine. So I'd be really interested to kind of hear your thoughts on that.
Oh, well, this is the moment where we need people like you and all your fellow intellectual historians more than ever, I feel, because actually I think that the idea that we're on a march of universal progress has now been proven wrong more so than probably it has been for some time. We're looking down the barrel of catastrophic climate change. We're now experiencing an enormous crisis given that's often when we talk about this pandemic, it's treated as a natural phenomenon almost when it's very much a social and political one. How we respond to it is guided by the social political context, but also the fact of its creation is a function of all sorts of social political practices that exist in relation to the natural world and how we engage with it. In the context in which also we're seeing radical movements of people demanding racial justice and an end to police brutality. These are the exact times where we need people who can articulate in accessible ways how it is that history happens, or why you can make an argument about what history is and what purpose it serves, how it's written and by whom and what that does, but also that, that how we fight for a better world can be difficult and not always straightforward, and that it's a contentious process, and that's one of the things about democracy, I suppose, that it's always going to be it's never peaceful in the intellectual sense. It's always a clash of ideas and a conflict of people's viewpoints, which is what makes it healthy. That kind of criticism is what we want to instill, not as an aberration, but in fact a norm, that we want dialogue and debate and questions to be asked about how we're moving into the future, and not allow or outsource that to just a select few who get to frame the debate. This is the moment in which that Overton window is really being expanded. And I think there's a real appetite amongst a whole generation of people who are now looking at a world that will be much worse than what their parents experienced, who are hungry for ideas about how to change that and what we might be able to do to safeguard the future of humanity. It's never been a more pressing question than ever. I'm keen to talk about technology because I think it offers some of the great potential to overcome some of these problems. I think that any kind of solution to things like climate change and even, police violence will involve some form of technology. So I think it's really critical that we have the tools intellectually to make sure that those solutions as applied are good ones and not bad ones. But I think absolutely, as a general point, this is the time more than ever that we need intellectual historians to be able to offer up guidance, suggestions, and to collaborate with social movements who are struggling so with such tremendous energy and force to try and create a better future.
Oh, well, you flatter us. You flatter the intellectual historians, of which we are entirely delighted. But thank you, Lizzie. We've taken up a huge amount of your time. So before we leave you, could you just give us a glimpse of what you're currently working on, or perhaps where the book Future Histories has now led you?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think it's been so wonderful, obviously, as part of what you do with the book is you talk to people who are reading it, and the audiences that I envisaged do present themselves in the physical format whenever I do an event for a book. So it's always just so lovely to meet people who are perhaps encountering technological questions for the first time, or perhaps engaging with them in a meaningful way and are looking for a guide to do that. And then also technologists who are actually engaging with the political questions and figuring out how to do that. And it's very gratifying to see that work in real life. And I'm hopeful that that will be the legacy of the book too, moving forward. I think as a lawyer at the moment I'm I have been for a while, but a class actions lawyer, I love doing class actions. It's literally large numbers of people coming together to hold one, a large, powerful entity accountable. And I work in the field of corporate misconduct. I think I may experiment. What I'm increasingly thinking is looking at some of the political economy of law and how law and economics works, because I sometimes think that a lot of people find law to be a bit mystifying, or also a source of moral guidance at times when I'm not sure it warrants that kind of accolade. And I think there's all sorts of ways in which you can look at the legal system as being influenced in perhaps unseen ways by economics. And I would like to put that in accessible terms for people so that that can be made plain. And that's probably my next project, to provide an everyday accessible guide to how the legal system works, but with an economics perspective in mind, so that we can understand both how it perpetuates injustice at times, but how it can be sometimes used effectively for progressive social change, and making sure we get that balance right. I think lawyers are often painted as heroes of some stories when they may not deserve to be, and that in fact so much of legal history that's positive for the world has come from people struggling for a long time to get that kind of change heard and articulated in court. And I sort of want to do some work that pays homage to that as well.
Well, that sounds like a fascinating project, and I really look forward to reading it in the future. I really want to thank you for being on the show today and for giving us so much of your time, Lizzie. Thank you. This has been an incredibly enlightening interview, and I hope that everyone goes away and picks up in your future histories.
Oh, I'm so grateful for the opportunity. Thanks so much for your wonderful questions. It was a real treat.